Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is, a free, daily, 30-minute program designed to help you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the Voice of America's Learning English Branch in Washington. Today on the program, we report on the sometimes strange way that American politicians and those who report on them speak. What is a frontrunner? A presumptive candidate. What does it mean when a candidate is accused of flip-flopping on an issue? You'll learn about those and other American political expressions today on As It Is. Then, as we always do on Fridays, we will bring you Mario Ritter's Economics Report. And as we do every weekday, we will present The Making of a Nation. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. The presidential campaign is now in full swing in the United States. In full swing is just one of the many expressions speakers of American English use that may be difficult for speakers of other languages to understand. It means at the highest level of activity or fully moving forward. Presidential candidates and the journalists who report on their activities use many political expressions. Most speakers of American English understand these words and phrases. But people who are not familiar with the ways American political candidates and reporters speak may not. Jim Tedder is here now to explain some idioms and expressions that have recently been used by American journalists and presidential candidates. You may find it useful to keep this list to refer to as you read about the presidential campaign in the United States. You can find it on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Frontrunner. The candidate who has the most votes or the highest level of support in public opinion surveys. Set the stage. Preparing an audience for an event. To make something possible or likely. To note that participants in an event are ready and that the event will begin soon. Sometimes a speaker will set the stage for a debate by telling people what candidates are about to discuss. The speaker might say, "The stage is set for an interesting debate tonight." Broaden his appeal beyond the base. Political candidates must work hard to become the nominee of their political party. To do this, they must convince members of their party to vote for them. Party activists are often called the base of their party. They are the strongest and most active supporters of their party. But political parties in the United States often do not have the majority of voters they need to win an election. Someone who wants to be president must convince many people who do not belong to their party to vote for them. So, after they become their party's nominee, and sometimes even before, they will talk about issues that are important to people who are not part of their base. This act is called broadening their appeal. Broaden means to make something wider or more general. Appeal means a quality that causes people to like someone. If a candidate does not broaden her or his appeal beyond their party's base, it will be difficult for them to win the general election. Presumptive nominee. This expression is often used to describe a candidate with the strongest support among party leaders and the public. Political experts believe the presumptive nominee will be the nominee of the party, although she or he has not been named the nominee yet. Flip-flop. Reporters say a political candidate has flip-flopped when they have a sudden change of opinion on an important issue. A politician who supports limiting gun ownership might change their position when surveys show voters do not support such limits. He knows that his support for limits may cause him to be defeated for re-election, so he changes his mind. Political reporters and opponents may charge the politician with flip-flopping on the issue because he or she is afraid of losing the election. Lash out. To attack in speech or writing. To burst into or resort to verbal or physical attack. A candidate is said to lash out at an opponent who has attacked her positions or beliefs when they react angrily and answer the attack strongly. Overshadows them all. There are more than 15 Republican presidential candidates, and at least 5 Democrats seeking their party's nomination. Experts say only a few of them have a chance to become the nominee. They say Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump overshadow their opponents. In other words, Ms. Clinton and Mr. Trump cause the other candidates to seem less important or impressive by comparison. The spotlight. Many politicians like the spotlight. They like public attention. A spotlight is a device that directs a narrow, bright beam of light on a small area of a stage. Rationale for running. Some journalists question why a candidate is running for president. The candidate may not have much support, and people may not have given them a lot of money. So reporters may ask what their rationale for running is. Some candidates run for office even if they do not believe they will win. They may want attention for themselves or for a political cause. Others run because they believe they are the best person for the job. Where does he fit into the conversation? Reporters may ask this question when a politician is considering entering a race that is already crowded with candidates. Why is he running? They might ask. What role would he play? They might wonder what the politician would offer that candidates already in the race do not. Foreign policy chops. A candidate may be highly experienced in foreign policy. They may be applauded for their chops. This is an informal or slang American English word that means skill or excellence in a particular field or activity, such as acting or playing music. Have you heard or read idioms and expressions in stories about the American presidential campaign that you do not understand? Let us know. We are happy to clear up any confusion or misunderstanding you might have. By the way, clear up means to explain. We hope this report has explained some of the idioms and expressions you have been hearing recently as the United States continues the process of choosing its next president. I'm Jim Tedder.
Thanks, Jim. That's our program for today. The Economics Report with Mario Ritter and The Making of a Nation with Steve Ember are coming up next. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the VOA Learning English Headquarters in Washington. We'll be back tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is from the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. The influence of China's economy continues to spread. But China's neighbors are facing new issues as they fight to stay competitive. Taiwan's economy has been hit hard in recent years. But some businesses there are finding a way to develop specialized markets and succeed, even with China so nearby. Ho Jiaobai's family has grown edamame, or hairy green soybeans, in southern Taiwan for many years. Fierce competition from China at one time cut Taiwan's exports of the tasty bean to Japan in half. But now, Taiwan has regained its position as the leading supplier. Mr. Ho says it is difficult to compete with China. But Taiwan's neighbor has a blind spot. In other words, the Chinese economy makes more of some products than others. Mr. Ho said that many people in China say all the country has to do is meet demand at home. But he added, less thought is given to opening up new channels or markets or improving the quality of products because few see agriculture as an investment opportunity in China. In Taiwan, government support and efforts to use machinery to increase crop production have been important. So have efforts by researchers to create new versions of the bean. Zhou Guolong is a government researcher with Taiwan's Council of Agriculture. He says innovation and new ideas have kept Taiwan's edamame growers from failing. He told VOA that we're not afraid of competing with China. What we're afraid of the most is that we don't progress and get stuck in a rut. Agriculture is not the only industry in which Taiwanese businesses are using innovation to create specialized or niche markets. The companies are also avoiding competition in highly traditional, standardized products, an area where China can do better. Liang Guoyuan is with the Uinta Polaris Research Institute. He says Taiwan's niche markets should center on products that are not made in huge numbers, but are diversified and customizable. One example of this kind of product is Gogoro, a smart electric scooter. Former HTC mobile phone officials recently demonstrated the scooters in public for the first time. The motorized device shows some of the manufacturing and high technology know-how that Taiwan is known for. The scooters are different from competing models because the power supplies can be exchanged at charging stations. local governments are offering financial assistance to those who purchase the bikes. The company hopes to market the idea in other countries. And that's the Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Early in 1857, the United States Supreme Court announced one of its most important rulings. The High Court decided the case of a slave named Dred Scott. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Leo Scully tell us about the ruling and the continuing national debate over slavery.
Dred Scott lived in Missouri, where slavery was legal. Then he was sold to a man who took him to Illinois and Wisconsin, where slavery was not legal. After 4 years, he was returned to Missouri. Dred Scott demanded his freedom because of the years he had spent in places where slavery was illegal. Congress had banned slavery in those places under the Missouri Compromise Act of 1820. The Supreme Court ruled that Congress did not have the power to close territories to slavery. It said the Missouri Compromise was a violation of the United States Constitution, and that Dred Scott was not a free man.
James Buchanan was sworn in as president at the time of the Dred Scott case. Buchanan believed the Supreme Court's decision would put an end to the dispute over slavery. He believed that Americans, North and South, would accept the decision as the final word in the dispute. This did not happen. The Dred Scott decision did not calm the storm that divided the nation. Instead, it increased its fury.
New trouble threatened to break out in the territory of Kansas between pro-slavery and anti-slavery settlers. In the past few years, the two sides had argued and fought over their opinions. They even had formed two separate governments. The pro-slavery forces controlled the legal government. The anti-slavery forces controlled an opposition government which had no power. Supporters of slavery wanted to organize a constitutional convention that could put Kansas into the Union as a slave state. The pro-slavery legislature passed a bill calling for such a convention. The bill gave supporters of slavery every chance to control the election of delegates to the convention, and it gave the convention complete freedom to make its own rules. The bill provided no way for the people of Kansas to vote on their own constitution.
The governor of the Kansas Territory, John Geary, vetoed the bill. But the legislature quickly overruled his veto. Pro-slavery men called for Geary to get out of Kansas. Some talked of shooting him if he did not leave. Governor Geary had been living under extreme tension for months. He had worked hard to keep Kansas peaceful. He was angry because he could get no help from the federal government. He sent his resignation to President Buchanan. Then the former governor spoke publicly. He said most of the settlers in Kansas were peace-loving people. He said only a small group was responsible for the trouble there. Geary said a few powerful men hoped to make Kansas a slave state. If this failed, Geary said, they hoped their actions would produce civil war.
President Buchanan appointed a new governor for Kansas. Buchanan told him that slavery in the territory must be decided on the votes of the people of the territory. And he said the people must be given a fair chance to approve or reject a constitution for statehood. The new governor arrived in Kansas at the end of May 1857. He explained his policies in a speech to the people of Kansas. The new governor promised to enforce the laws of the pro-slavery legislature, but only those laws which were constitutional. He urged everyone to vote in the coming election of delegates to the Constitutional Convention. He said he was hopeful that the convention would offer its constitution to the people for their approval or rejection. He added that Congress would not accept Kansas as a slave state or a free state until the people had voted on the question of slavery.
On June 15th, the election was held for delegates to the Constitutional Convention. Most anti-slavery men did not vote because their names had been kept off the voting lists by pro-slavery officials. Others refused to vote because they believed the election was unfair. 60 delegates were elected. All supported slavery. They planned to meet in the autumn to begin work on a constitution for Kansas. Most of the delegates were wild, rough men who found it difficult to read and write. But these men were sure of one thing. They wanted Kansas to be a slave state.
The delegates began the Constitution by claiming that the right of property was higher than any constitutional power. They said a slave owner had as much right to his property as the owner of any other kind of property. Then they wrote the different parts of the document. One part of the Constitution severely limited the right of the legislature to free slaves. Another part barred free Negroes from entering Kansas. And another prevented the Constitution from being changed for 7 years.
Most of the delegates to the Kansas Constitutional Convention wanted to send the document directly to Congress for approval. They did not want to give the people of Kansas a chance to vote on it. They were sure that the majority of the population would reject a constitution that made slavery legal. Some delegates, however, knew that Congress would not approve statehood for Kansas unless the people voted on the Constitution. The two sides finally agreed on a compromise.
The Constitution itself would not be offered to the people. Instead, the people would vote only on the question of slavery. They could vote for the Constitution with slavery, or the Constitution without slavery. If the voters approved the Constitution with slavery, then Kansas would be open to new slaves. If they approved the Constitution without slavery, then Kansas would be closed to new slaves. Slaves already in the territory could be kept there. This compromise brought a cry of anger from opponents of slavery in Kansas. They said the Constitutional Convention had only given them the right to vote for limited slavery or unlimited slavery. It had not given them the right to vote for freedom.
President Buchanan had promised the people of Kansas that they would have a fair chance to vote on their constitution. But members of his cabinet told him to forget this promise. They said Americans were tired of the dispute in Kansas and would accept any settlement. They told Buchanan that approval of the Constitution would end the Kansas problem. It would satisfy the South, they said, and the North would soon forget about Kansas. Under this pressure, President Buchanan made his decision. He would ask Congress to accept the pro-slavery Kansas Constitution and make the territory a slave state.
In Kansas, the vote on slavery was held. Most opponents of slavery did not vote. They were waiting until they could vote against the complete statehood constitution. Many of the votes were illegal. Still, Kansas officials declared that slavery had been approved. They urged Congress to make Kansas a state under this condition. Shortly after, President Buchanan sent Congress a similar message. Buchanan's chief opponent on the statehood bill was a member of his own Democratic Party, Senator Stephen Douglas of Illinois. Douglas did not oppose slavery, but he believed that the people of a territory had the right to make their own decision to accept or reject slavery.
Stephen Douglas united other Democrats and members of the anti-slavery Republican Party to fight against the bill in the Senate. He lost. The Senate approved the bill to make Kansas a state where slavery was legal. The House of Representatives, however, rejected the bill. Instead, it approved a bill to let the people of Kansas vote again on their statehood constitution. The Senate approved a compromise version of this House bill.
So the people of Kansas got another chance to show that they did not want a pro-slavery constitution. They voted and rejected the Constitution by a large majority. The pro-slavery statehood constitution was dead. Kansas would continue as a territory for a few more years, but there would be no further attempt to make it a slave state.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Harry Monroe and Leo Scully. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs can be found, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. And you can follow our series on Twitter at twitter.com/VOA Learn English, spelled as one word. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.